welcome to this edition of Coastal Cafe. My name is Aaron Barnett. I am with Washington Sea Grant. Coastal Cafe is a joint production of the University of Washington Sea Grant program and KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. Our goal is to put science, policy, and other information related to Washington State's coastal zone into the hands of those that need it. Today we're speaking with Dr. Ian Miller. We're going to be talking about his work on the Lower Elwha sediment monitoring that he's been doing. Hello, Ian.
Hello, great to be here. Thanks.
So, Dr. Ian Miller is Washington Sea Grant's coastal hazards specialist, working out of Peninsula College in Port Angeles. Ian works with coastal communities and public agencies on the Olympic Peninsula to strengthen their ability to plan for and manage coastal hazards, including tsunamis, chronic erosion, coastal flooding, and other hazards associated with climate change. Ian led the development of Washington State's most recent sea level rise assessment and has also partnered in the development of comprehensive climate change vulnerability assessments for the Jamestown Tsklallam Tribe and communities on the North Olympic Peninsula as well.
Yeah.
Well, welcome again, Ian. So could you please give us some background on the sediment monitoring you have been doing at the mouth of the Elwha River since the removal of the two dams, and what is your role with that project?
A large group of people, and I'm just sort of a player in sort of what I view as kind of an ecosystem of scientists and interested citizens and nonprofits and just this sort of enormous group of people, became interested in trying to figure out how to best sort of understand what this dam removal meant for the coastal environment in particular. I'm involved in three projects. One is one that I lead, which is a sort of routine monitoring of what we call beach profiles and beach grain size. This has been going on consistently since 2011, and then sort of intermittently before that, dating back to 2008. And it's kind of coupled up with a project that the U.S. Geological Survey actually started in 2004. So we've got quite a long sort of time series now, and really sort of a pretty incredible data set for understanding how the Elwha Dam removal has influenced the shoreline. The second is a annual survey that the U.S. Geological Survey leads that I'm a partner on that actually attempts to map the elevation of the entire delta. So it takes a team of people a couple of days, and we actually end up with a fairly high resolution elevation map of the entire delta, including the bathymetry, the parts that are underwater. And then the third project that I'm involved in that's actually just wrapping up now is focused more on the ecological influences in the marine environment. So how did all that sediment from the dam removal influence marine organisms, change habitats on the seafloor, that sort of thing?
Do you have any idea how much sediment was transported down the valley from after the dam removed?
Yeah, so we have a fairly good sense of what we call the sediment budget. In the same way that you budget your money in, money out, we tried to mostly led by other people, try to get a sense for how much sediment started in the reservoirs and how much ended up in the river and in the coastal environment. So we estimate that a total of 30 million metric tons, which is a hard number to kind of wrap your brain around, but a colleague of mine, Jeff Duda at the U.S. Geological Survey, has calculated that it is equivalent to the volume in 8 CenturyLink stadiums. So if you can envision 8 CenturyLink stadiums stacked on top of each other, that's kind of the volume that we're talking about. So that's material that was in the two reservoirs. And then during the dam removal, so basically from roughly 2012 to 2014-15, about 65% of that, or 20 million metric tons, was eroded from those reservoirs. So a little over half was moved into the river. And then most of that, somewhere around 90% of that 20 million metric tons, made it to the coast. So very little of it sort of stayed in the river, but had important consequences in terms of the river and changing the nature of the river and that sort of thing. But most of it made it to the coastal environment. And of that 18 million metric tons that made it to the coastal environment, we can currently find about a third of it, right around the river mouth. The rest of it has dispersed widely, and most of that was mud, fine material that the Strait of Juan de Fuca, which is what the Elwha dumps into, is fairly energetic. It's got strong tidal currents, and that fine stuff just sort of distributed away. But so we can currently track about 6 million metric tons. You know, another way that I sort of think of to put these numbers into context is that during the dam removal period between, say, 2012 and 2015, the amount of sediment making it to the coast was equivalent to a dump truck pulling up to the river mouth, dumping its load every minute of every daylight hour for a 5-year period. So it gives you a sense for how much work the river was doing to transfer this sediment from the reservoirs down to the coast.
That's kind of a nice segue to my next question, which is a before and after type. So what do you think was going to happen, and how is that different from what actually happened, and what opportunities or challenges arose out of those differences?
Yeah, so, you know, the questions that we were asking about the coastal implications of the dam removal, first of all, it's important to note that, you know, the coastal sort of implications of the dam removal were kind of a side note from the standpoint of the project. You know, the Elwha Act that was passed by Congress didn't really set any metrics of success in the coast. Most of the focus was on, you know, the river, fish recovery, turbidity in the river. So most of our efforts in the coast were really sort of very motivated by scientific questions primarily. So as a consequence of that, though, you know, we didn't have any real rigorous modeling, for example, on which to base predictions in the coastal environment. So, you know, most of it was based off of people's previous experiences or assumptions or maybe applications of knowledge from elsewhere to the Elwha. So one of the things that I thought based on my own dissertation research, which I did down on the beach at the Elwha, and it was focused on basically how waves push sediment along the beach. And when I was doing that research work, which was all happening prior to dam removal, I was finding that waves were pretty effective at moving sediment very rapidly along that beach. I was using a tracking technique where I was following individual grains of rock, cobble, as they moved along the beach, and they moved very rapidly.
Could you go into a little more detail on that tracking mechanism?
Yeah, so what I did for my dissertation research, and I should point out that I remain astonished to this day that I was able to do this. Very interesting work, though. Mm. But I essentially embedded pit tags, which are passive integrated transponder tags, equivalent to what many of us have in our car keys now, or our pets oftentimes have them embedded in their shoulders. Our phones will oftentimes have them in them. So it's a widely sort of used technology. But I embedted those into rocks, essentially, cobbles and gravel on the beach, and then tracked them for different periods of time under different conditions, wave conditions and forcing conditions. Did that repeatedly over a set of maybe 2 or 3 years under all sorts of different wave conditions and seasons to try to understand how shoreline sediment transport happens, in particular on the sorts of beaches that we had at Elwha at the time and are widespread in areas like ours, which are called mixed beaches, that sort of are a mix of sand and gravel. So my focus was on trying to understand those sorts of beaches. But one of the things that we learned is that on the Elwha, that stuff moved really quickly. And so as a consequence of that, I thought that that when the material from the dam removal made it to the coast, that it was going to be very rapidly transported away from the river mouth. And in fact, that didn't happen. So that kind of drove my expectation of what, you know, what to expect. That didn't happen, though. A lot of that material deposited right at the river mouth. It built a sort of an extensive kind of new mouth area, which, you know, if you've visited the mouth of the Elwha, you've definitely sort of seen and experienced it. It's become a very different kind of beach environment. And a lot of people are heading down there now just to sort of enjoy this kind of nice, kind of sandy, pleasant beach, whereas before it used to be very cobbly and steep. But anyway, that material kind of built this extensive new mouth area, built up something on the order of 60 hectares of new estuary environment. So really kind of reconfigured the mouth of the Elwha. We had an interest in trying to understand the influences of the Elwha Dam removal distant from the mouth of the Elwha on the shoreline. And one of the interesting things that I saw in my data was that erosion of the shoreline to the east of the river mouth continued well into dam removal. It really wasn't until about 2015 that we saw the patterns of erosion to the east of the river mouth reverse and that shoreline start to build. And that was something that I would have guessed prior to the start of dam removal would have happened much more rapidly. So that was certainly one thing that I was struck by.
So there's a term for that. Is that nourishment?
Yeah. So we use the term nourishment, shoreline nourishment, to refer to this idea that, you know, as we sort of add sediment into the shoreline system, that a beach will essentially grow as a consequence of that. You know, I sort of oftentimes make the point that we studied the Elwha and the implications of the Elwha because of the dam removal. And it's important to get a sense for what that dam removal was all about and what happened as a consequence of it. However, I also view that dam removal as a shoreline nourishment project, essentially. And I'm really interested in how widely dispersed the material from the Elwha is on the shoreline, the patterns and processes at play. That's definitely an area of focus for me.
Is there anything of note that you'd like to share that you've learned on that very same topic?
Well, so certainly in regards to what we've seen at the Elwha at this stage, we now think that we can identify the influences of dam removal all the way to the base of Eddy's Hook. So that's, what is that? Maybe 6 miles distant from the river mouth, something along those lines to the east. And then to the west of the Elwha River mouth, we can see the influences of the dam removal sediment for at least a mile or two, if not further. And that's on the shoreline. You know, we also know that there are places on the seafloor that have also been fundamentally altered by that sediment in terms of, you know, a shift in the nature of the habitat on the seafloor from, for example, a cobbly seafloor to a sandy seafloor. So that there's places where that has occurred as well. So we're interested in kind of the rate that that nourishment has occurred. How quickly, for example, does that material move along shore? And of course, the magnitude, how much has the shoreline changed at a particular location? And that varies across the shore. You know, we really don't have much experience with large shoreline nourishments in the Pacific Northwest. There are very few isolated locations where, you know, we've had the opportunity to track large amounts of sediment that have been added to the shoreline. And so this is a great opportunity to kind of understand how that material distributes and how much of it stays on the shoreline, how long does it last, all those sorts of things.
So it's kind of like uncharted territory.
In a way, for our region, yeah.
And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Coastal Cafe here on 91.9 FM, KPTZ in Port Townsend. We've been talking with Dr. Ian Miller, who is Washington Sea Grant's Coastal Hazard Specialist, on his work at the Lower Elwha Dam. So we have all this new real estate, so to speak. I'm kind of wondering, how does shoreline nourishment on a scale as big as this affect things like the Shoreline Management Act, local zoning codes, individual property rights, whether it's tribal or municipal? Do you have any thoughts on that or any tangential experience with outcomes in that area?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting wrinkles to shoreline environments. The only other analog that I'm really aware of are rivers, you know, where property lines can essentially move around associated with either accretion or erosion or, you know, building out or removal of sort of property along that fringe those two environments. And so these are very interesting examples. You know, typically we tend to have a little more experience with erosion just because there's more of that effectively than accretion examples.
And I know out there erosion is a big problem for property owners.
Yeah, and certainly prior to dam removal on the Elwha, erosion was a significant problem for along wide swaths of the Delta. So you know, in general, I think as a society, we like accretion or the building out of the shoreline more. We tend to view that as an overall positive, but it does introduce complexities. You know, a few that I've experienced on the Elwha are associated with things like mapping shoreline buffers for shoreline master plans. You know, shoreline master plans in Washington State sort of provide guidance for where certain things can be built on properties with setbacks that identify how far back from the shoreline they have to be. Those are typically mapped from lines like ordinary high water in Washington, which is generally associated with a vegetation line. So where vegetation can grow on a shoreline. Well, at the Elwha, when we had, you know, 20 feet of seaward growth of the shoreline that happened very rapidly, faster than vegetation could grow, essentially, you know, there were question marks about whether ordinary high water was sort of 20 feet seaward of where it used to be and whether that would allow people to do things in a zone of their property that they would have been more limited in before. So those are interesting challenges and questions that people have to deal with in situations like this. You know, there's questions of ownership as well. You know, in the case of the Elwha, there are state tied lands. The tribe plays a role in managing the shoreline. And then there's private property owners that typically own sort of in the zone above ordinary high water. So that as that line changes, that introduces complexities in terms of whose land it actually is and who has to manage it.
That's a really interesting point, because in Washington State, one of the things that makes this state unique among other areas around the country is the leasing and selling of property below the high water mark. And I just want to point that out to our audience that is unique to this state. So in the research for this interview, I found some interesting stuff in New England, you know, where they talk about dam removals in these old communities that once relied on the dam, and the town identity was related to that dam that ran a mill or a textile fabrication company or something like that. So looking at other dam removal processes around the country, we see much conflict and compromise between stakeholders, you know, up to the point of dam removal, which we saw, you know, in the initial conversations about the Elwha. Do you see potential conflicts arising after dam removal as a result of the creation of new real estate? I mean, potential conflicts beyond what we just talked about?
So I think that there definitely is room for, I don't necessarily want to call it conflict, maybe, although it certainly could be in some instances, but, you know, confusion, right? Landscapes that are changing and evolving always introduce maybe confusion into things like property lines and determining, you know, whose is what and who's responsible for what. So that can introduce confusion and conflict, certainly. You know, I feel like we haven't seen an enormous amount of that at the Elwha, although it has been there. You know, the other source of potential issue associated with a project like the dam removal on the Elwha is just associated with, you know, the river reoccupying sort of new territory that it hadn't been able to access for some time. So the great example is in Olympic National Park, which has lost two campgrounds and a large portion of a road because the river sort of migrated newly into this area that it hadn't been in for quite some time. And that causes, you know, that causes concern and problems, and people are disappointed that they can't access these areas that they used to get into. The park, it's a cost burden on the Olympic National Park. So that's all problematic. One of the efforts that, you know, should and usually does go into dam removals is just trying to get a handle on what all of the implications of dam removal are, and then hopefully weighing those carefully against the benefits and values of removal. You know, dams are a tool, and they the benefits of that tool need to be weighed against the costs. So, you know, if that count, and hopefully one of the things that we can take away from the Elwha and other dam removal examples from around the country is just exactly what the costs are and benefits of removal, you know, so they can be weighed carefully against the costs and benefits of keeping dams in place where they stand.
So it almost sounds as if incorporating something like marine spatial planning could be a helpful tool, depending on where the dam is.
Yeah, in instances in which the dam has a considerable marine influence, the Elwha is an example of that. That may be the case. Marine spatial planning or some other planning structure would be totally appropriate for considering, as a tool for weighing those values. A lot of dam removals happen in tributaries of rivers, and they don't necessarily have a significant coastal impact, but yet you still want to do that process of weighing sort of the costs and benefits of keeping the dam in place or removing it.
Well, maybe marine spatial planning will be our next topic. Thank you for helping with that. So, Ian, could you talk about some of the ecological work you've been doing with respect to the Elwha project?
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, part of one of the projects that I'm working with is focused on trying to understand how the dam removal has influenced marine habitats near the mouth of the river. So to address those questions, we go to the bottom of the sea. We use scuba diving to get down there and actually count things that are living down there. So we are actually tracking invertebrates and algae and fish at a set of sites that we've established and revisited now for many years. And looking for patterns associated with dam removal. So that work is important, not only, again, to address exactly what happened with this dam removal, but also as a way to understand broader patterns about what controls the populations of these marine animals that are, can be very important to us societally, commercially, for example, or, just because people enjoy sharing the world with these kind of interesting organisms. So, every summer in a project that is led by the U.S. Geological Survey, but involves divers like myself from the University of Washington and from the Lower Elwha Klallam Tribe, and U.S. EPA has contributed divers at times. We visit a set of sites. From that, we've learned what I think are some really fascinating things about the way that these marine and sort of habitats and the animals that live in them and algae as well made it through dam removal, and in some cases appeared to thrive through dam removal. So let me talk about a couple of examples. Going into the dam removal, we were concerned, I guess. There was concern that we heard voiced that the sediment from the reservoirs when the dams were removed was going to sort of have something of a catastrophic effect in the marine environment, that it was going to sort of blanket the marine environment with mud and that it would, it would be devastating. We didn't find that to be the case. And in fact, we found, so we have something on the order of 15 sites distributed around the Elwha Delta, 15 sites that we dive. And of those, only 5 of them saw any sort of seafloor change, right? Any sort of deposition that changed the nature of the seafloor. So the rest, we didn't have that kind of deposition, but they were influenced by dam removal, mostly via turbidity. A lot of stories of sort of ecological kind of resilience and hope, I think, came out of the project as well. Places where we saw the seafloor change, where sediment deposited on the bottom and kind of buried the previous habitats, you might expect that it would take a while for those sites to recover. But in fact, that process of recovery was fairly rapid.
I think that wraps up this first edition of Coastal Cafe here on KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. I've been with Dr. Ian Miller, who's Washington Sea Grant's Coastal Hazard Specialist working out of Peninsula College in Port Angeles. And I'd like to thank you very much for joining us on this historic event.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ian. Bye-bye. This is Aaron Barnett, host of Coastal Cafe, a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington and KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. I'd like to thank our program manager, Larry Stein, and production engineer, Jared Dufresne. Washington Sea Grant is working in your community to help us better understand and address the challenges facing our ocean and coastline. Have a great day.